Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Juror 13 show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin. For the next hour, I will be your co-host for tonight's program. And co-hosting with me tonight is victims advocate Cherry Simpson. Cherry, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Denny. How are you tonight?
Greetings. Glad you could make it with us. And Dave is here also.
Good evening, Denny. Good evening, Cherry.
Good evening, Denny. And David.
And our guest tonight is Mr. David Laban, and David is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, a national association representing elected and deputy or assistant prosecutors and city attorneys. The association acts as a global forum for the exchange of ideas, allowing prosecutors to collaborate with all criminal justice partners, and conducts timely and effective training and technical assistance to improve the prosecutorial function. In addition, APA serves as an advocate for prosecutors on emerging issues related to the administration of justice, development of partnerships, and implementation of problem-solving strategies. And Dave, welcome.
Oh, well, thank you, Denny. Good evening
okay.
to both you and Cherry. Sorry about that.
And Cherry, we were chatting, Dave and I, a minute or so before we went live, and he's had a conflict tonight, so he can only stay with us for about 20 minutes. So
okay.
Without further ado, I will turn things over to you. I know you had some questions you wanted to raise with Dave, so why don't you go ahead and get into it?
Hi, Dave.
Well, good evening.
I'm so glad that you're doing this. I just think that it's a wonderful educational thing that you're doing to help victims. And the first thing I wanted to ask you, and maybe you could tell some of the audience, a little bit of what exactly do prosecutors do, and who is your client?
Absolutely. The role of the prosecution is that to seek justice. And so on behalf, and you said the client, it's really on behalf of the people of the state or of the United States, whomever is the folks that we're representing in bringing the criminal charges, that we look at the case. And under an ethical obligation, we need to make certain that the right person has been accused and that they've been accused of a proper crime and that it's reasonably likely, is our obligation, that a jury or a finder of fact, it could also be a judge trial, will return the verdict of guilty. And if all of that is the case, then we proceed to file charges. And then once the charges are filed, that's really the power of the prosecution. From there, it goes into the judicial process with the accused. Then if it involves jail time, afforded an attorney, and then we're in front of that judge or jury to determine guilt or innocence. We are not, as much as we work with the victims, we are not the victim's lawyer. So if, for instance, the defense is trying to get private information about a victim, on the state side, we can seek to quash the subpoena, but we can't advise a victim as to what they should or should not do. But always the object is to seek justice and do what is right. In the same way, if there is something wrong with the case, it's our obligation to dismiss that case or not to proceed.
All right. And I'd like to also ask you, why are family violence victims treated differently from other criminals, victims of crime?
I don't know what you mean by being treated differently. It is our hope and effort that all victims are treated the same. If when you say with family violence that it involves many times also a family court, that is different because many times, unlike someone who's a robbery victim, there's no parallel civil case going on with the robbery case. It's just the criminal case. But many times, especially and unfortunately, with issues like domestic violence, there is likely a parallel family law case, and so that does complicate the criminal proceeding, as well as even when the criminal proceeding is over, there's still a family law proceeding.
Well, I think I'm speaking about the fact that it does seem to be a big difference between stranger crime and non-stranger crime. Just if you look at the statistics on what somebody could get for, say, a battery charge by a stranger and compare that to the battery charge that a victim of domestic violence would get, it can vary greatly.
Of course. And what that relates to is not necessarily, or it's not the role of the prosecution. It's our role to present the charges and to pursue justice. What you're referring to is, what does the judge do? As a prosecutor, we don't get to sentence. The courts are the ones that sentence. And absolutely, if somebody in a bar fight hits a stranger, they're going to receive a much more, even though it was a bar and there's alcohol and other mitigating circumstances, they will receive a much harsher punishment from the judge than someone who does that same behavior in the home. You are absolutely right.
And that, I guess, leads me into asking about orders of protection, because it almost seems as if that's an untrue statement. I mean, I've often thought maybe they should be called "please stay away," because they really only work if the batterer pays attention to them. And
yeah,
most violations of orders of protections go unpunished.
I'll agree. And both parts of that is yeah, it's called a protective order, or some folks in some courts do refer to them as stay away orders. They are only as good as the paper. And if you're speaking of someone who otherwise isn't going to follow the law, how is that protective order going to make them follow the law any better? And then the importance of someone, when they have a protective order, to make sure that their local policing authority knows that there's an order in place. Because if that doesn't happen, then the victim, not only of the previous domestic violence, but ultimately of the violation of the protective order, has to do a lot of explaining and may not get the emergency protection that they deserve.
Yes, I know I do. There's three women are killed each day by their intimate partners, and almost a quarter of them have orders of protection in place. And they don't seem to be doing, they're kind of like toothless tigers, I guess you'd say, because they really don't have any bite to them. And I was very surprised by that going through the court system. I'd like to ask you also, why are they not using more danger assessments or lethality assessments in the domestic violence cases?
Well, I think that's going to be specific as to different regions and areas. Having originally come from California, the threat assessment has become more of the process and is being used a little more, but you know, that's first it's a resource issue. Is it available to that local court? Is it available to the local probation? And in addition to that, many judges are going to look at were these folks originally married, or were they cohabitating? How was it that they got in front of the court? And even with a lethality assessment that comes back and says how dangerous that individual is, there are some courts that are still going to say, "Oh yeah, but they were married." You know, as you talk about sort of a second class victim, they will give that deference, and it is very, very unfortunate.
Yeah, I bringing up the fact that they are victims brings me around back to victims' rights. Even though we hear an awful lot in the courtroom or on television about the criminal right, we don't often hear that much about victims' rights. And I was just curious, are victims' rights actually enforceable? Has there been anyone that enforces victims' rights in the past?
Yes, and then I would kind of put the asterisk there as far as which of the victims' rights are you referring to. When the victims' rights, and I think the most egregious case that I like to talk about is the right to a speedy trial. And so often, and when I was a local prosecutor, the fact is we would go to court, we're ready, and I handled, we're talking tonight about domestic violence cases, I handled a number of domestic violence cases where the partner was ready to stand up and face the person that assaulted and terrorized them. They're finally ready to go to court, and we walk in that courtroom on a day that's supposed to now become a judgment day, and defense isn't ready, and so they want a 6-month continuance. Well, if it was flipped and we weren't ready, then the defendant would have a constitutional right to a speedy trial, and the case would likely be dismissed. But because it's on the other hand, with the defense not ready, they usually get that continuance. So when you talk about trying to enforce the victim's right to have their case decided, when you have a parallel right on the defense side to their representation, almost always, if not always, the defense is going to get that continuance. And if, in fact, there is a judge that does stand up and pushes the case to trial, now suddenly there's an appealable issue there that did they receive adequate representation under their Sixth Amendment rights. So as much, and I've been in the criminal justice area since 1986, so this is my 23rd year, we're getting better as far as balancing the scales of justice and remembering that there is a victim and there are victims' rights. But unfortunately, any time when you have two parallel rights, it always defers to the defendant, and that's the system of which we operate under and we have to operate under. So,
is it a possibility that a victim can have an attorney represent him or her in a criminal court of law?
Yes, as far as, and that's why I said, which right are you talking about? When you talk about privacy rights, to have an attorney there when they're trying to get into medical records, trying to get into employment records, financial records, absolutely. And it's really unfortunate that suddenly a victim has to have a counsel, has to have their own attorney in order to protect themselves from being re-victimized. But yes, but not a private
prosecutor. Can they actually speak for the victim, though, in the courtroom?
They can speak for the victim as to those particular issues of where that victim's right is one that can be enforced, and ultimately we hope that the court will enforce it. And I'm here in the Northern Virginia area, and Maryland has a very active program, as does Arizona, about getting representation and trying to enforce the victim's rights. In fact, that was a national program that I was trying to get funded for on behalf of the Association for Prosecuting Attorneys. I thought that was important to have a counsel to be available to help victims enforce their rights.
Oh, I agree. I think that a lot of the shelters do work along with there's certain legal aid offices. I know that my daughter has gotten legal aid help. She also, when she was in Chicago, she had a legal representation, but she wasn't allowed to speak to the court. She got to speak to the district attorney, and in fact was made certain that I could read my daughter's victim's impact statement to the court, which I thought was very good. Something that I don't think a lot of people realize is that victim's impact statement can also be sent to the probation officer assigned to the pre-sentencing report in the weeks prior and to the prison review board after sentencing, and it can significantly influence the sentencing and probation. And
absolutely. That's great advice. to the listeners?
Well, I think it's horrible what's been happening. I know that we've had it's almost every day that I see a news report on family members that are murdered, wives and children that are murdered. And in fact, there was one just today out of Phoenix where a family court judge ordered that the father would be able to have visitation with his children, and he murdered his wife and children that next day. And even though he had tried to commit suicide several times, the family court judge modified the order of protection that was in place, which I have a hard time understanding how family court judges have the ability to modify a criminal order of protection. That doesn't make sense to me.
Right, and that's what I mentioned about how many times the family case continues or lives on past the criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
And during the pendency of the criminal case has precedence. But what you described does happen. That criminal case is over, and a family judge will come back and modify the order. Because that's the current pending case, therefore that judge now has primacy. And yes, that's incredible, but again, that's the judgment of the family court superseding what the criminal court has already done.
That what surprises me so much about that is I should think that the real experts in the criminal law would be in the criminal court.
Yes.
And, I mean, that makes logical sense. And yet then a family court judge, because they're trying to, I'm supposing that they're trying to maintain some kind of family, I don't know how you can possibly maintain a family that is made up of someone that is, a severe batterer or a rapist or a murderer. But it seems like that everything has kind of gone upside down in this world. And
I understand it from a prosecutor's perspective. I totally agree. There's no question, and I have prosecuted a number, especially child sexual assaults, unfortunately, and to think that someone that we have prosecuted and finally brought justice forward on it, and now suddenly a family court judge looks and decides that it's in the best interest of the family that there is reconciliation, it blows my mind. I cannot explain that.
I know, it's hard to understand. I do think, though, that anybody that's listening or anybody that's a victim of domestic violence, that they should come forward, they should prosecute. I think that there are shelters that are out there that can help you. I know in my daughter's case, they wanted her to go all the way over to Joliet, which was almost an hour away. But all we had to do is make a few phone calls, and we got her into the South Suburban Family Shelter, and they were wonderful. They helped her with many things. And I think you can do that. I think what happens a lot of times is the victims get re-victimized sometimes, and they don't understand the process, and it's frightening. It's horrible to go to court.
Right. And it's such a huge life step to decide that they're finally done with whatever that situation is and they're ready to step forward. And they need to be supported, and your daughter's actions are great. I applaud that. As well as yourselves, your work to continue to speak out and try to improve the system is what needs to be done.
Well, I think that it's your job as a parent to protect, and it is the job of a mother. I mean, normally that protection would fall to the father, but I have to tell you, as far as domestic violence is concerned, there's very few men that I found in the system that were willing to help and be helpful. But it's nice to see some, like you. And Steve Twist and of course, Denny, we really appreciate that. and applaud that. So I know you you said that, I don't know, when is it that you've got to get going? Pretty soon?
Yes, I have. I was in the midst of a meeting, but committed to the show and believe very strongly what you and Denny are doing. So I wanted to make sure I was here for you.
Well, Denny, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah, I told Dave, asked if he could do 15 or 20 minutes, and I said, yeah, that would be great. And it's been about 20, so should we wrap it up at this point? And maybe Dave would consent to come on back some other time when we can go on from here.
Oh, absolutely. And I didn't know if there was any questions for the audience or anything else you had for me this evening.
Nothing's come in yet. I think probably with the time frame, people might have been holding back on questions, so we didn't get tied up. What if I get a hold of you, Dave, and we'll pick another time that maybe we can spend another half hour or hour and get into more questions and audience questions and listener questions.
That sounds great.
I'll be in touch with you on that. And Cherry, is that okay with you? And we'll do it another time for a little longer.
I think that sounds great.
Okay, Dave, thanks so much for being with us tonight and giving up some of your meeting, and we'll do it again in the fairly near future.
Okay, I look forward to it. And, Terry, keep going. I so much applaud your advocacy, and, Denny, your show is outstanding.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Terry.
Yes, sir.
What I thought we'd do, since we've got some time left, about just under 40 minutes, I thought maybe I'd give you just a chance to rest your throat here. You've been carrying the ball since we started. I was going to spend a few minutes talking about the new show I've come up with, and then maybe we can take some questions through the chat room or some phone calls. The phone lines obviously are open. Anything anybody wants to talk about, it can be domestic violence, it could be whatever, but does that sound okay to you?
That sounds great.
Okay, and if anyone would like to call us, you can reach us at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. So probably most of the listeners are aware, Nikki at Juror 13 has decided that she wanted to get back into doing some other things and take a break from running the website. So the Juror 13 site has been shut down. I had some shows, Juror 13 shows, booked ahead of time. So I'm going to go ahead and finish that. Those shows up, and our last scheduled show will be on December the 9th. That'll be the end of the Juror 13 programs. But I've really enjoyed doing these shows, and I've learned a lot. For example, the crimes against children and domestic violence, I knew they existed prior to doing these shows, but I wasn't aware of the depth of the problems, and it's really scary to me. And I don't want to just drop the ball here. Whatever we can do, I think, is beneficial to make people aware and try to educate people, try to get a dialogue going about these problems. So I didn't want to just totally give up on the ideas. So what I've decided to do was open a new show in January, and my working title will be The Griffin Chronicles. And what I plan to do is cover many of the same topics that we covered on Juror 13, which would be domestic violence. Obviously, we want to get David LeBond back on. And we have some other great guests who would be who we've never had on before, who I've become aware of, and have some repeat guests of, from previous shows we've done under the Juror 13 name. Also, now we got the news that just broke tonight about the little girl in Florida having been missing and now been found dead, apparently. I didn't hear the news flash, but someone told me about it. It's being talked about in the chat room. So another crime against a child. And, of course, the Anthony case is still waiting trial. And Haley Cummings in Florida is still missing. Her. What happened to her is unknown. We got the situation in California with the, I forget the name offhand, but the Sunday school teacher that allegedly killed a little girl. So that there's still a lot of that kind of stuff going on that I think needs to be kept going, talking about it. And, of course, trials. I know Juror 13 started out primarily discussing current investigations, current trials, retrials, and we did a few rehashes of some of the older trials. So I'd also like to do that, but we can even get into other things. I mean, those are things I want to cover, but I think there's room to get into many other topics that are of interest to this particular audience. So it'll all be pretty much law enforcement or judicial system related. I'm not going to get into politics or that type of thing. But well, I say not get into politics. There are certain cases, I guess it would be politics in the sense, like we were just talking about tonight and on previous shows, where the justice system isn't necessarily fair to the victims, or is perceived not to be fair. So
right.
Perhaps that would be, some might call that politics, if we're talking about how to try to get legislation passed or hold judges accountable and so on and so forth. But anyway, so those are my intentions, and I'm planning to take a couple of weeks off over the holidays and get organized, and then sometime in January have the kickoff show for the Griffin Chronicles. So anybody's in the chat room has a comment, what you think about that, or you want to call in and discuss it, or if you have some other ideas, I'd certainly like to hear from you. And I will also, from time to time, be calling on some of the listeners to give me a hand with the show, as Cherry's doing tonight, Delilah has done in the past, and Annie. Annie's out there, and she's going to be helping in the future also. And help me out with the guests, because I was at a conference one time and the speaker started out with, I think I can remember pretty much what he said, something that says in the Bible that Samson slew the Philistines using the jawbone of an ass. He said, but I'm not going to do that to you tonight. So if I get a subject that I'm not really up on or don't think I can talk intelligently about or make an interesting show of, I think I would use that same little speech. I would gladly have a co-host or someone who's more up to speed on whatever we're going to be discussing, and I would kind of keep my mouth shut and watch the telephones, watch the switchboard, and watch the chat room, and let somebody better than I take the lead. So, again, I would probably have to be calling on people from time to time to give me a hand. And based on what's happened under the Juror 13 name, I don't expect that would be a major problem, getting some of the people to participate. So, anyway, that's kind of where I'm going. And, again, I'm open to suggestions or comments. Anybody has thinks it's good, bad, or whatever, please let me know. And if I don't hear any negatives, I'll go ahead with my plan. And I do another show, too. I co-host with Kim Colton, the Seeking Justice Show. And we are covering, most of the cases we cover are deaths, usually of young adults, that are classified as suicide or accidental, but there's substantial evidence that they are, that homicides are more likely than accident or suicide. And those cases are interesting. And we run into some people, I've been contacted by some people, who their cases don't really fall into that category. And when I get something like that, I might use the Griffin Chronicles as a venue to profile certain things or discuss certain things that aren't quite suitable for the format on the Seeking Justice show. So that's another area I might get into with the Griffin Chronicles. But I think I can put together something fairly interesting and entertaining. Okay, Cherry, I'm I'm out of breath now. Do you want to get back at it?
Sure. I wanted to tell you that I have been listening, and I think everybody out there should know that they can either call in. They don't have to have the internet to listen. They can call in and listen live, or they can podcast it later, which I like to do when I'm doing the laundry or the dusting, and I listen to your show, and it really helps pass the time, and I've learned quite a bit from listening to your show. And I want to say thank you very much, because there are very few shows out there that are victim-friendly, and victims need help. They really do. I've become part of a contributor to a blog that is new called Time's Up, and it's Solutions for Victims. And just information that can possibly be shared to help these people to get through the justice system and the different things that they actually have, that there are tools out there that they can use to help them. It's made up of a great group of people from all different areas, some of them advocates, some of them professionals, some of them even spiritual advisors, all things that victims need. But there's nothing like, Denny, listening to you actually interviewing, you know, a victim and listening to how it's not sentencing the criminal in our system. It's sentencing the victim a lot of the time. You know, so you're giving them a much needed voice, and I want to thank you from, you know, all of the victims that are out there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Cherry. And it's been, it's a frustrating thing, because, I don't know, sometimes I think it's like shoveling sand on the beach, you know, that you're not making headway. I know we are making headway, but I'm not, patience isn't my strong suit, and dealing with the system. You know, trying to get changes and trying to see improvements is requires patience, and sometimes I'm a little short in that category. But I do think it helps.
You have what's needed, and that's faith. And I think you that's why most advocates do what they do, because they believe that something can change. It only takes one person, and everybody can contribute something to help someone else. I honestly think that is the light that God brings out of the darkness. And you're a great part of that, Denny. And
Thank you.
It's important.
Let me just say one thing. We're going to the last Juror 13 show on December 9th, in fact, is going to be another domestic violence themed program. And I just mentioned Annie. Annie's going to be the co-host for that show, as it turns out. And we're going to be discussing among other things, involving men in the fight against domestic violence. I know that some of the earlier shows that subject came up, are any men involved? Can we get more men involved? Because it adds, I guess, in some ways, it adds more credibility. It's not just a woman's thing; that it's a people thing, and we're going to have a guest on that night to talk about that, and about getting more men involved in the the fight against domestic violence. So it's turned out, I think that's going to be a great show to finish the Juror 13 shows on.
I like that. That's a good one. You know, without women, there wouldn't be any men. So
that's right. Good point. Good point.
But we need them, too.
Yes, yes.
And the good ones are the ones we want. So.
Just to, lest I forget, the show on the 4th of November. I got a show on the 4th of November, then I'm going to be away for a few weeks, so it'll be November 4th will be a show, and then the final show on December 9th. And the show on the 4th is, some of you may know, and for those of you who don't, I write books in my spare time, and I've gotten into organized crime stuff. I started out with fiction, but I've done quite a bit of organized crime writing. And I've met several former mobsters, if there is such a thing as former, I guess there is. And I'm going to have one of the newest ones, one of the my most recent contacts on November 4th, and this guy's the real deal. He's a witness protection graduate, and he's, I call him the baby, he's 44 years old. Most of the other ones I talked to are in their 70s, so he's the youngest of my my former mobster associate. And he, in fact, is still testifying. He's from the Gambino, an associate of the Gambino family out of New York City, which was the John Gotti wing. And he testified against John Gotti Jr. in the previous trial. And he's got a couple of other trials pending that he's probably going to have to testify at. So he's kind of, you know, the real deal, and he's a current involved with some current things going on. And when he's emailed me his bio, I considered it a resume. I got a chuckle because if he was applying for a job, it starts out pretty much as, I've had a 20-plus year career in organized crime, and I'm experienced in and have been charged with, then he goes into hijacking, possession of stolen property, transporting stolen property across state lines, loan sharking, murder, attempted murder, or not, no, excuse me, not murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, assault with a deadly weapon. And as I was reading that, I was trying to think of myself as a potential employer and going with this thing. But he really has quite a history. So if anybody's interested in picking the brain of a criminal, a real thing, we'll have him on the 4th. And then, like I said, then December 9th, the domestic violence program. And then sometime in January, probably mid to late January, we'll start with the new show. And I'm just wondering, does Wednesday night work about as well as any other night for anybody? I don't want to get involved with Mondays because in the fall here, of course, you would be fighting or competing against Monday night football. So what do you think?
I think Wednesdays are nice because it's in the middle of the week. And I think it's a good time. Denny, that all sounds really wonderful. I know I gave my husband your book for a summer reading, and he just loved it.
Oh, good.
He couldn't put it down. And I think you'll have a lot of, I think, you know, a diverse listening group. You know, I know that he'll tune in to hear you talk about the mob. You know, we're originally from the Chicagoland area.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, we've known people that were involved in that kind of. Well, kind of. We got invited to a wedding one time, and there were several mobsters there, and so were the Chicago High Police. So, but It's interesting. I know that he'll find it really interesting, and I'm sure all of your listeners will too.
Yeah, it's funny. But there's one guy I deal with. He's from the Genovese family in the city, and he never turned. He retired, and he said he'd have gone to jail for the rest of his life before he'd have talked. But the feelings that these guys have now, he's one of the old timers, and really the omerta thing, you know, the silence thing, and the code of conduct, and the way they look at these people who have turned to become government witnesses and do what I would probably say was the right thing, regardless of the reason, if they've given up their, you know, given up the info on the bad guys. But it's amazing that the feelings some of these old-time mobsters have toward the what they call the rats. And they're really passionate about their hatred for him. It's kind of surprised me that they've, after a lot of years, and in some cases, they've carried that that animosity.
That's interesting. Are you writing any more books, Denny?
As a matter of fact, I've got a project. I'm currently still in upstate New York. I'm getting back to Vegas on the 3rd of December, and I'm switching a little bit. Probably no one listening is old enough to remember a group of dancers. They were actually formed in the 20s, but they performed up into the 60s and 70s, called the Four Step Brothers. And they were tap dancers, so four blacks, it was a black group, tap dancers, and they were the opening act for a whole bunch of famous stars of the day. Martin and Lewis, they were their opening act, and they performed here in the States and abroad. At the time when there was when they weren't allowed to take regular elevators inside the casinos, they had to use freight elevators. They had to go in the back door. They had to eat in their dressing rooms. They weren't allowed in the dining rooms. And there's one person left from that group who's 92 years old, and we're going to conspire on the story of black entertainment, and they broke the color barrier in Vegas, as it turns out. And like I say, the guy's 92, but he still does a dance step on occasion. And so I'm going to get away from crime a little bit. I'm going to stick with history, though, and I'm going to get into the breaking the color barrier for entertainers in Vegas, and not limited to Vegas, but with the main focus on Las Vegas.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun, I think. And Jerry Lewis was instrumental there, so I'm going to, I think, get to interview him, and that'll be kind of a unique thing.
Oh, yeah, that sounds really like, that sounds interesting and fun. I know that my father-in-law, who's passed away, he always loved all those entertainers and would often have the kind of the old versions, I guess, of what MTV is like now, and we would watch them with him for hours. There were a lot of really really good black entertainers back in that day, and to think that they, you know, had to entertain under such bad rules, you know, or bad behavior where they would be mistreated and not, you know, discriminated against. And of course you've got Sammy Davis Jr. out there, you know, too. There's a whole another story that you could do with that.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because Jerry Lewis said it, this was confirmed by this survivor of the group, that they were going to be the opening act for Martin and Lewis at the Sands, at the Copa Room.
Uh-huh.
And Lewis was around looking for them to talk to him a little bit before the night show. And he was looking for him in the dining room, and they weren't there. So he asked one of the management people, he says, "I can't find my opening act, where are they?" "Oh, they're eating," he said, "but they had to go to their dressing room because being black, they aren't allowed to eat in the dining room." And Lewis says, "You got to be kidding me." "Well, no, that's the way it is." He said, "Well," he said, "here's the deal." He said, "either you fix it and you fix it now, or there'll be no Martin and Lewis show tonight." And the guy says, that was management's turn. He said, "You got to be kidding." He said, "I'm not kidding." He said, "We will not go on unless this is resolved." So he said within about 5 minutes, they had an answer that the stepbrothers would be allowed to eat in the dining room. So Lewis went to their dressing rooms and told him, he said, "Come on, you got to come up to the dining room and eat." He said, "Well, we just ate." He said, "I don't care if you only have a piece of pie or something." He says, "This has got to be done. The ice has got to be broken." So they went up and they had a piece of pie in the dining room. And that opened the gate for him. And Sammy Davis Jr. was also appearing in Vegas on and off during that time frame. And the wife of the surviving member of the stepbrothers said that because, you know, it was just getting where black entertainers could even be in the building. Mm-hmm. And they certainly, nobody wanted to see a black male and a white female. That was certain. I mean, it was bad. To a lot of people, it was bad enough they were in the building, much less mingling. So what she did, because there was Sammy had a white woman he was interested in, the wife of the dancer would be more or less the chaperone. The white woman would stay with her and sit with her during the shows so she could come in and watch Sammy perform. And people apparently would accept a white woman with a black female, but they would not have tolerated at that stage of the game if they knew that Sammy was involved with the white lady. So I guess it was quite a time, and they really had a, you know, it was tough sledding if you were black at that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, he lost his eye.
Yes.
Because of that. Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's just amazing what they did back then, and hopefully that's changed. I mean, that'd be interesting also to see, you know, how has it actually changed. I mean, now we have a black president, so
yep.
I'm hopefully yes that it has changed, but I know that there's still prejudice.
Yeah, it's I think it's a lot better than it was, but you're right. I'm sure it's. You know, I see examples of it periodically, and. You know, I've always been that I try to judge people on their own merits, not because they're part of something, be it religion, be it race, whatever, because there's good and bad all over the place. And being
right.
A certain color doesn't make you either one. I think it's what's inside of you that makes you good or bad.
I think that God gives us each, you know, How can somebody brag about having blue eyes, you know, or green eyes? I mean, that's something that God gives them, and that's who they are. And God made all these different races, and they are, you know, all wonderful creations of God. So I don't know how. I think it's terrible that we do have prejudice. I wish we didn't. You know. I'm hoping that as a society we're starting to get a little bit better in that. And I think it's ironic, though, that we've you know, here we abolished slavery, but we still have this domestic violence and that is occurring. It's almost like another form of slavery. I mean, I seriously wonder why they don't look at domestic violence the same way they do POWs or tortured victims. Because that's what they do, and then they want to complain and say that, you know, the woman chooses not to leave. Well, you can understand why she might not want to leave, because if she did, the police don't do anything about it. I mean, if you just compared those two things, you know, racism and domestic violence, and I'm quite sure that once the slaves got their freedom, they didn't know what to do right away with it.
Right.
You know, they didn't know where to go or didn't have anywhere to go or to make a living or whether or not they'd be protected. I think it's similar, and I would hope that, you know, we would begin to do more for victims' rights instead of criminal rights. And I last time you were on with David LeBon, you were talking about Marcy's Law, and he was saying how it cost the family millions of dollars, you know, to get that law passed. Me, that's horrific that it
sure.
would cost an individual family millions of dollars. But that does seem to be, you know, what's funny about this, Denny, and this is why I think it's a shame with men and women. You know, when you walk into a room, it used to be, you know, if a woman walked into a room with a baby and there were a lot of men and women in the room, you know, the men might turn and look at the baby and say, oh, look, there's a baby. But, Denny, every woman in that room would go, oh, look at that baby. Oh, he's so cute. Can I hold it? What can I do? It's nurturing. But nowadays it seems more like the family courts are putting emphasis on financial, or that the fathers, you know, would be the better providers, and nurturing's just, you know, out the window.
Right.
And I fear for that. That's a terrible. I just think that's terrible. Motherhood should not be thrown out the window.
Terry, let me ask you a question. I was just thinking as you were talking, you know. A lot of people, and including myself at times, have asked, well, you know, well, why did she stay? When you hear these stories, that's a reaction from a lot of people, and I was like that. Well, you know, couldn't she have left? Now, you were just making the point that, you know, some don't know where they would go if they left or what they would do. But do you think some of the horror stories we hear about the system, in other words, when a woman does at whatever point or after whatever period of time, makes the move to get out of the situation she's in.
Uh-huh.
Do you think if they hear horror stories about what happens to some of these victims after they do leave and they get into the system and the way they're treated, do you think that would be a discouraging thing? In other words, if somebody says, geez, I'm thinking about making a move here, and then they find out that, holy mackerel, I get into that court system, they're going to take my kids, or, you know, that kind of thing.
I don't think it's the stories. I think that from personal experience, I know that personally, when I found out what was happening with my child and I spoke about it, the first thing complete strangers would say to me was, what did she do to deserve it? And my response to that, when Dennis said that to me, my response was, well, you would not have said that if this had happened to an animal, to a dog. You wouldn't say, what did the dog do to deserve, you know, to be beaten and raped and, you know, almost killed. But for some reason, it has to, from what I can tell from reading all that I have been trying to bone up on the prosecutor end of it, because we were having David LeBon on tonight, there's a big difference between stranger and non-stranger crimes. And for fear of sounding a little like Johnny Cochran, non-stranger crimes get no time. So it just seems to be the way that not just society, but the judges and the police officers and prosecutors will often look and just, it's instinctive for them to want to blame the victim.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do that, though, in stranger crimes. Stranger crimes, they have more success in prosecuting. They have they will often get, you know, many more years of sentencing and things like that. For some reason, I think domestic violence, when it involves intimate partners, they have a tendency to think that it's just love gone bad. Well,
mm-hmm.
love is not being beaten. And what I believe in my heart is put the sin in the sunlight, put it out so that it can be seen. That's what I started to do, and that's what I encouraged my daughter to do, and it took the power away from the batterer. And that's why I encouraged her to let the Chicago Tribune follow her for 6 months. Now, the Chicago Tribune paid a reporter and a photographer to follow her for 6 months. We had to send them over 40 pages of documents showing what she said was true. And I encouraged her to do that not only to help her, but I always thought when her children got older, they'd be able to make an informed decision on what had really happened. And I would encourage mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and friends to tell someone, you know, go and tell your pastor if you know this is happening to your child or a loved one, you know, because the more that it's talked about, the more they can't hide their crime. It's no different than any other crime. That's the way I believe. And victims' rights are human rights, and we should be out there trying to help these people, and especially women and children, Denny. You know, I mean, the statistics show that children that are battered and abused, the criminals will often only get a quarter of the sentence of what they would if they were adults. Now, that's horrible. You would think it'd be, you know, four times as much.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, I think it's because of the stranger and non-stranger crimes, and it's the defense attorneys have become so that they will tear apart someone's, you know, reputation. They can scream and yell on the stand, you know, in the courtroom. And I think they do that to make you lose your train of thought or to upset you, and then you can't think right. It's intimidation. It's arrogance. And you have to stand up to that. You know, we live in America, and I often think back to, you know, the early days of America, and one of our ancestors is John Adams, and how he fought for freedom in this country. Well, we're still fighting for our freedom,
mm-hmm.
And there's an awful lot of domestic violence victims that need help fighting for their freedom.
You know, Terry, you just mentioned about the being torn apart, you know, through the court system and stuff. And I was thinking that probably if you don't want to be torn to shreds by someone, by a lawyer, probably other than maybe running for major political office. I mean, I know that gets pretty down and dirty in politics, but probably being a witness in a trial is just about as bad as it gets. I mean, what they do to the witnesses in some cases, you know, they dig into everything, and if you ever jaywalked or something, it's going to come out, and they just try to tear you apart. So it's not, I mean, sometimes you're the known witness, and you have to testify, people know who you are, but somebody who might have information on a case, you know, they might not be as apt to come forward and say, okay, I saw this or saw that, knowing they're going to get dragged into something, and that some lawyer is going to be out there wanting to destroy them, destroy their credibility. And it's that's really a shame. I mean, if you know, certainly if there's good reason to discredit someone, to discredit their testimony, but going into some of the things that these lawyers get into strictly to destroy the person is,
But Denny, you know, it shows like what you're doing, you educate people on what it is. You don't have to answer right away. You mm-hmm. can, you don't have to answer the whole question. You can take it in parts. The shelters are great. They have tons of advocates that will go to court with you. They have attorneys that will work with you and talk you through. And it's just like anything. you know, when you go to the doctor, you don't go to the first one. You might get a second opinion. If you don't like the advocacy that you've been getting, seek out another shelter. You don't have to stay right there. A lot of people think that you do, but you don't. You
right.
can you can go, you can move on and find someone until you feel comfortable.
Right.
And parents and brothers and sisters, help those and talk about this in your churches. You know, there were numerous times when and I know there's victims that don't go to church because when they go to church they cry.
Oh.
Well, that's where you should be crying in church, and these people need to know that this is what's happening and that they need help.
Right.
And I, you know, I don't think that's a bad thing. There's, you know, Denny, there are terrible things that happen to everyone in life, but it can make you into a better person also. You can
right.
rise up to be that better person and help them.
Terry, we just ran out of time and got cut off the live stream.
Okay.
So we filled in admirably. Thank you very much for being here tonight and helping me out. And we'll get David back on, and we'll continue with him at another time when he's not, you know, tied up or has other commitments. And,
well, I think it'd be really great if you could get that Christina on, because I know that she specifically is working on laws to help
okay.
women. You know, and they specifically talk. There's so many aspects of this domestic violence, Denny, that you know no one touches on, such as rape. There's a woman that I've been talking to. Now that we're off the air, I can say this. There's a woman that I've been talking to that she was kept and tortured, and her husband was bringing multiple men in to have sex with her. And she's tried to, I know, this is not, you know that you spoke to that, the other woman from, you know, where her husband's in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's happening. I don't think it's any accident that Gerardo is doing what he was doing out in California. I think that it's becoming more prevalent. And unless we talk about it, unless you shine a light on it, it's not going to go away. You know, I think you're doing an excellent job. I listened to you when you had Melody on the other day. You did great. I loved
oh.
it. I couldn't put it down.
Thank you. Well, Terry, thanks again for helping me out tonight, and we'll get her done. We'll keep going.
Thank you.
Okay,
you have
a great night. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.